Good morning. Good to see you all. I'm sitting on this platform, which is a new phenomenon. We got this just because we felt like it'd be nice for everyone to be able to see the speaker. Not really because any of us wanted to sit on a throne. But it made me think of when I was very early in my practice here. I must have been within the first year. And they were hard times. I came here because I was having hard times. And I had a dream one night that I was practicing Zazen in the Zendo here. And I fell off the back of my cushion and through the floor. And I was lying inside the floor, suspended in a fluid, laughing uproariously while I looked at a room full of people sitting in stoic and beautiful silence. So hopefully even though I'm sitting up on this thing, I could still be down in the floor. Just hanging out with you guys. So my topic for today is delusion and intimacy. Delusion and intimacy. So, as kind of a startling aspect of our tradition, to acknowledge that basically we're invited to see that everything we think and believe is absolutely real is delusion. This is a startling and challenging way to look at the world. But I am hopefully going to give you some encouragement to take this up as a liberative way to look at the world, a liberative way, a way that liberates you into intimacy, connection. So delusion is generally considered part of a set. So greed, hatred, and delusion. That's the way we usually see them written, and these are considered, are usually called the three poisons or kleshas throughout Buddhist thought. I prefer to use the terms desire, aversion, and delusion. Because greed and hatred sounds pretty specific and intense, and desire and aversion reminds us that these can happen in very subtle ways or very intense ways. Anyway, so these three things are not necessarily helping us be intimate with people. And early Buddhist thought really emphasizes healing the tendencies, the emotional tendencies that drive desire and aversion. So, you know, we get really angry and we're just like, I want you out of my face. Or we get something we really like and we're like, how can I get more of this? You have a brief moment in Zazen where you feel very peaceful and you think, what did I do? How can I make that happen again? And, of course, in that moment, it flies away. So Mahayana Buddhism, of which Zen is a school, really, really emphasizes delusion as the fundamental issue that we're trying to heal. And I personally think both methods are really good, and so I tend to emphasize both. And as some of you know, this is the central tenet of Yogacara thought, and I'm a big proponent of what's called Yogacara Buddhism, which is about bringing these things together. So anyway, how do we heal these tendencies of desire and aversion, delusion that drive human suffering? So there's some clues, and I'm going to talk about karma theory. That sounds fun, doesn't it? So karma is understood variously by lots of different people, both within Buddhism and out of Buddhism. It's a really big, fundamental concept for Indian thought, and so I'm going to be talking about it in a very specific way. I'll take as a principal quotation, a common saying in early Buddhist texts. The Buddha said, karma is intention. As one intends, one does actions, and creates karma. Karma is intention. As one intends, one does action and creates karma. Intention here, though, it's hard to translate the word, the ancient word, which I actually don't remember what it is. But what we're talking about is not so much like cognitive intention as the subtle, unconscious, emotional drivers of our behavior. So when we're really wanting something, we're driven by a kind of intention. Or when we're really afraid, that is an that fear drives our actions. That's an intentional formation. So anyway, these emotional and cognitive drivers, this is what karma is about. And this is really what the principal emphasis of early Buddhist teachings are about, how to get us to not just reproduce the same habits that drive the same patterns of suffering and show us that we have a liberative choice in every moment. So we have this karma theory thing. And then, attached to it, there's another saying of the Buddha, which is, actions willed, performed, and accumulated will not become extinct until their results are directly experienced. Actions willed, performed, and accumulated will not become extinct until their results are directly experienced. And then there's kind of a dot, 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 and it says, until this happens, there will be no end to suffering. So actions, actually karma is a word which means action. So he's talking about karmic actions. So when a karmic action happens, like I have a strong emotion or I have an idea about things, that is going to produce future karmic results. So if I think that person over there is a jerk, I'm going to experience the results of my thinking he's a jerk, which is probably that I will not feel good. It doesn't feel that good to think someone is a jerk. Or if I have a strong emotional state, generally speaking, that strong emotional state conditions the mind to experience a similar emotional state later. And that puts that into the whole world because everything is connected. So the key point here in this thing, actions will performed and accumulated, will not become extinct until their results are directly experienced, is the direct experiencing. Direct experiencing of these karmic phenomena within our beings. Strong feelings, subtle feelings, and thoughts. Actually directly experiencing them. So what is it to directly... Well, let me talk about what it's not to. And I say this all the time, so I'll just say it again. When you're really angry, you usually don't know you're angry. You know someone else is a jerk. It's very simple. The human mind is going to try and jump out of the direct experience of what's happening here emotionally and put it in some external sphere. Because it thinks, it's conditioned to think that that will help it to be safe, that it can manipulate those things. But this is a fundamentally disempowered position. If we focus on the direct experiencing, we can focus on what we're doing. And we can do something liberative because we can free ourselves from those karmic results that have been piled up, as Buddha says, without discoverable beginning. He doesn't say forever. And he doesn't say through your whole lifetimes. He says, without discoverable beginning. That's a long time. So, what we're doing here, what is being encouraged, and what we see in our meditation practices, is that we are seeing these unconscious aspects of our lives. So, being really deeply attuned to the emotional content of experience right now. And I'm going to talk more today about being attuned to the delusive or cognitive contents of experience, but they're a little harder to talk about, so I'm going to go to that in a minute. And I think this will be familiar to everyone. When we sit, we should be attuned to how we feel. And normally, you know, you have a feeling, you sit in zazen, and you're like, I'm kind of peaceful. And then you have a lot of thoughts, and then you remember like, oh man, later on, when I leave this stupid session, I'm going to have a pizza. And that pizza is, yeah, I'm going to get like green peppers on my pizza, yeah. Wow. And we're not attuned to the desire. We're just absorbed in this thought. So then we We go, Zazen, I'm here. And we go, how do I feel? Hopefully in that moment of breaking from the thought, we see how we feel. So if your practice is not enabling you to be more attuned to how you feel, find a way to be sensitive to this part of yourself. It's the principal grounds of our liberation, according to the Buddha. And you're not going to... It's not like thinking about how you feel. It's deeply sensing it. And just like when... I'm sure everyone here has had some experience of walking out in the last week and looking at some tree and just thinking... Just seeing it. Just letting that direct experience touch you. So this is the direct experiencing, the flavor of it that we can have with our emotional contents of experience. And if we do this, those emotional habits that are harmful or cause us suffering, their power starts to dissolve in the light of that direct experience. So I think of this as bringing something unconscious, a part of our experience that we might not be attentive to, into consciousness. So as Carl Jung said, until the unconscious becomes conscious, we'll be driven by it and we will call it fate. Sounds kind of like karma, doesn't it? So we can be free. We can be free. Just cultivating intimacy. So we generally, a lot of the focus of meditation practice in these teachings is on like a bodily sensation and the sensory field because they're less activating. Our emotions are very activating and we really want to hide from them. So you want to allow rootedness and just these simple physical sensations and the sounds and the sights and the body to be the tether that holds you in the moment and opens up your capacity to be aware of this element of experience. But delusion and all these emotional pieces, basically desire and aversion get subcategorized in Buddhist thought into massive lists of types of emotional experience. But well, you get the hopefully you have some idea of what this could be. Fear is kind of aversive, right? Anger is aversive. Sadness, we're just like, I don't even want to see the world. Or desire, like, oh, how can I get some more? Anyway, these three operate as a like they operate together on the surface of our consciousness to keep us, it's like a little loop. So delusion, what is delusion about? We could say delusion in Mahayana thought is that there are things that are separate from other things ultimately. So it just sort of seems like things are separate from other things ultimately. If you just look around, you know, I assume everyone in this room feels like they're a person separate from the things they're observing. Maybe not. But for most of us, it's like, oh yeah, it does kind of feel like that. And it feels, you know, you'd be like, that's Ben's hand and not my hand that's waving in the air right now. And the mind's doing this all the time. The wall is separate from the ceiling. And so sometimes your mind is doing this very actively. You're thinking, that guy is wrong and I'm right. And we're really thinking that way. But this is also happening all the time unconsciously, so that everything in this, whatever that is being experienced right now in the senses is being unconsciously categorized. Right? And that's why we feel, oh, I know what's going on. Everything's cool. So this is, you know, just the way the human mind is conditioned. And, you know, it has its value. But it's very limiting. And the principal way that it's limiting it is it's always separating. It's always creating separation. So what cognition does is it separates something completely undivided so that it can be manipulated. So it takes something, a total intimacy that we're already in, and divides it. And creates alienation. So the intimacy that we're talking about here is what is. time, the idea that there's a moment separate from other moments of time is just an idea. So our mind says, oh, we got, there's a moment. That's different from other moments. It's dividing. And intimacy is shattered. There's a me that's separate from other people, and intimacy that's shattered. So there's all these, and if you look down the line, you'll just see this is the way this works. Now, some kinds of breaks in intimacy are more intense than others. You know, we feel this. But generally speaking, like Mahayana Buddhism presents the human experience as this kind of frustrating attempt to manage and control something that's incredibly vast. When if we would just remember, we could see that we're already in something totally intimate. To open up to intimacy. So we end up with alienation. And alienation, just meaning, you know, feeling separated and cut out from things. And, you know, people have been... Alienation is a big theme of 20th century Western thought. I don't know if you guys know this. Marx, Karl Marx, way into it. Hey, I'll read you some Marx. The alienation from the self is a consequence of being a mechanistic part of a social class, the condition of which estranges a person from their humanity. So Marx's interest was class, so he says, oh, class is the problem. And then you can find other people. Everyone wants to make their particular issue the issue. But Mahayana Buddhism says alienation itself is the issue, and it's happening from the way we think and conceptualize. So we end up in this weird situation of like, what would it be if how we dissolve the karma of things is by directly knowing them, going back to that original piece, what is it to directly know this delusion? And this has been a real puzzle for me. So in a way, I think we start to see it. You know, I think this hopefully will ring true for you. Practice Zazen, and one of the first things you realize is, holy moly, I think a lot. And not only is that one of the first things you realize, but after you've been doing it for 15 years, if you're like me, that's the first thing you realize when you sit down again. Holy moly, I think a lot. Wow. So what's happening is this, like the direct knowing, I'm going to argue that it's a permeable, or it's not like there's direct knowing and not knowing. It's like there are layers. So the thing is, just seeing that thoughts are thoughts is a subtle level of direct knowing. Because normally with thoughts, we're just like completely absorbed in them, right? You just walk down the street, you don't even know you're walking, you don't know what you're seeing, and you're just imagining something happening or solving a problem or thinking about something from the past. And when you have a sense that those thoughts are thoughts, just like feelings are feelings, there's some direct knowing. So the power of all that cognition to just drive our lives is subtly or slightly dissolved. But this is kind of a beginning. I mean, maybe this rings true to some people. You can be sitting in Zazen and there's like a thought, and it's just like, not only is it like I just realizing you think a lot, but you're like, that's just a thing. Like there's a sound, there's a feeling, there's a thought there. What is that? So there's even more of a sense of being directly aware that this phenomena is happening, that a thought is arising. And then, you know, the invitation in early Buddhist thought gets pretty deep. They're really like, they're saying you should be able to see each individual cognitive act as it arises as a momentary phenomenon. So like when a word comes up, you're like, that's a word. Word, that's a word. Right? This is called being aware of the aggregate of perception. For those of you who are really into Buddhism, I'll say there's five aggregates: form, sensation, perception, formation, and consciousness. Perception is cognitive naming acts. So the idea of these early Buddhist people is like, I'm just going to see every single cognitive naming act as it comes up as a distinct phenomenon. Not believing the story, because all these words I'm saying, we don't believe I'm making some truth statement. But I'm not. I'm engaging in delusion with you guys. This is what I do all the time because I love you. Because this is just I guess this is a digression, but I wanted to say this before. Delusion isn't, it's when we say things are delusive or deluded, it doesn't mean they don't matter at all. Delusion is what we live in. It really matters. We've got to take care of it. But normally we don't take care of our delusions as delusions. We take care of them as the ultimate truth. I do. You know, and wow, I just get in trouble that way. So to take care of these delusions together as delusions, realize their power. Their power. Buddha didn't say like, yeah, there's some delusions. You just think about it for a couple days, maybe sit, do a MBSR course and you'll be all set. It's like, this is without discoverable beginning. And you can realize what I'm talking about right now, but you might also realize it in 700 eons. That's cool. We're here together. We can do it together. So these delusions, you can direct seeing, just knowing that a thought is a thought. And if we're talking about the meditative process even more, you know, maybe this rings true for some of you. It's like sometimes you sit zazen. I mean, you might have to do it for quite a while, but you'll be sitting there looking at the wall and it's not a wall anymore. You don't know what it is. I saw Bob Dylan on Wednesday. Something is happening here, but you don't know what it is. And it's kind of scary. Oh, scary. So then your mind jumps back in. Oh, it's a wall. Okay. But, you know, you can meet people like this. People you think you know exactly. Oh, here he comes again. You can actually meet them and be like, I don't know. What is this? And actually hear people. Hear them how they are. Dissolving delusion through direct experience. So this opens up. This opens up intimacy. You know, I've heard a lot of people say, I'm so cranky with this person all the time, and then I just tried to really listen to him, and every time I walked up and was about to just start my little chattery thing about how I didn't like him, I just said, let's try listening. And he found connection. You can do this. So there's a koan, an old Chinese koan. There was an old woman living alone in a hut. A monk on pilgrimage met this old woman living alone in a hut. He said, "Do you have any relatives?" She said, "Yes." He said, "Where are they?" She said, "The mountains, the valleys, the plants, and the trees are all my relatives." Intimacy. Intimacy. You can walk outside here and realize that these are your relatives. This is your family. Bede Makaska. We're so fortunate to live near this place with some natural beauty. But you can go find it. You can find this intimacy everywhere, but I do think being around some natural environment helps, and that's a whole different Dharma talk, or a lifetime of practice, maybe. But yeah, what fortune we could go out and just look at the water. It's different every time. Bede Makaska. That's the new name. Actually, that's the old name. Let's call it the real name for that body of water out there. How many people here feel like they don't know how to say bidet makaska? Let's say it together. Bidet makaska. That's pretty good. Is there anyone here who speaks Lakota who can correct us? I do my best. I listen to a Lakota person saying it over and over online. Bidet makaska, you can say it. You say it wrong, that's okay too. The work of liberation is messy. And you know, it's important, it's good. If we want intimacy, it's good to say bidet makaska. I just found out that people have been campaigning to get that lake called bidet makaska for at least 15 years. I don't know how long, but at least. Wow. Why? Because we're sitting on land that was taken through violence. And the people who are part of that tradition, the Lakota people and other Native American peoples from whom the land was taken, are still really suffering from that violence. William Faulkner once said, "The past is not dead. It's not even past. It's alive." Intimacy. We think, oh, we're in this moment. That's another moment. All moments are intimate. So this theme of Lakota, the Lakota people, makes me think of Black Elk, who was a Lakota spiritual teacher, and I'm by no means an expert in Lakota spirituality. And this passage that I'm going to read to you was narrated to Black Elk by a white man who then edited it. But I think it speaks to intimacy. This is a vision that Black Elk described. "I looked ahead and saw the mountains there with rocks and forests on them. And from the mountains flashed all colors upward to the heavens. Then I was standing on the highest mountain of them all, and around about them beneath me was the whole hoop of the world. And while I stood there, I saw more than I can tell, and I understood more than I saw. For I was seeing in a sacred manner the shapes of all things in the spirit, and the shape of all shapes as they must live together like one being. And I saw that the sacred hoop of my people was one of many hoops that made one circle, wide as daylight and as starlight, and in the center grew one mighty flowering tree to shelter all the children of one mother and one father, and I saw that it was holy." Connection. Intimacy. And there's an excellent footnote here. So he says he's standing on this mountain, which he then says is Harney Peak. And it's, but in a vision, he's not what we had traditionally called physically there. But he says there's a circle of hoops with the Lakota in the middle and all the other people outside. So he says, "I was standing in the center of the world." Then he says, "But everywhere is the center of the world." Intimacy. All things are bound together. All things connect. The alienation we perceive is just a conditioned habit of consciousness from which we can be free. I should be forthright, though. This book is principally a really sad account of the violence of the United States against the Lakota. But there are some really beautiful spiritual visions as well. So, degrees of delusion are kind of like degrees of feeling. You know how, like, you can be just, like, completely verklempt. Really, really upset. You know, we all know, I assume everyone here has experienced that. In all different ways. You can be really angry, you can be really ashamed, you can be really sad, you can be really joyful. You can have all kinds of really strong feelings. Wow, super excited. But then there's also like a massive gradation, right? And sometimes it's like, maybe like if you get into this practice, you'd be like, oh yeah, I'm very calm, but there's a little bubbling excitement and there's just a little flavor of sadness in there too. Living together, we can become really, really sensitive. Sensitive. That would be a good comparison. Like an orchestral conductor. So I've worked with orchestral conductors, and you know, you'll listen to music and you're like, oh, that sounds pretty good. Cool. I like the sound of that. That's like, you know, I like the sound of that. And then this orchestral conductor will be like, yes, can I hear the three flutes? Because I believe the one in the middle is just a little bit flat. And then I'll be like, I need the second violin to just articulate just a little more tightly on measure 13 in that little passage. Sensitive perception. We can have this kind of perception of the emotional content of experience. And we can have this gradation of perception with delusion as well. So, and this delusion, if seeing how tied it is to alienation. So, I don't know how many people here have had the experience of gardening at Hokkyoji, our retreat center. So we go down there for a retreat, it's work practice, and you go into the garden, and you're in the dirt, and you get some food, and you walk into the kitchen, and the Tenzo cooks it, and you eat it. Wow. How does this feel? Just if you don't know, imagine how it feels relative to walking into the store and, you know, grabbing a thing of broccoli and throwing it into your thing. So getting close to these processes helps us to see how connected we are. So we live in an environment that creates a particularly high level of alienation because it's just like, consume this. Don't think about where it comes from. Don't think about where this comes from. Because it comes from a system that is not just. Don't we know that? The people all over the world who are living in abject poverty, making stuff for us. And we're, you know, getting some nice stuff. It's easy, you just throw it in your basket. So, to move towards that is to move towards intimacy, to move towards realizing all these connections, to seeing all the people that were involved. Or compare like eating your meal, if we make a focus on the intentional quality of delusion, like sitting here and eating a meal during a retreat, where it's just, you know, you maybe do an orioki, and you've gotten beyond the level of just being like, why do I have to hold my spoon this way? And you're down to the point of like just totally experiencing lifting a spoon up. Not getting the food from your mouth, but actually just, wow, I'm lifting a spoon up with food on it. Relative to standing over the sink eating a burrito. Really? In l'étranger. Oh. I would love to have a French person throw a tomato at me. In the book The Stranger by Albert Camus, which by the name might suggest it has to do with alienation. The protagonist says, I went down, bought some bread and spaghetti, did my cooking, and ate my meal standing. Went alone, bought the food, ate it standing up. And he felt separate. We can move towards intimacy. We can see how the way we're living creates our alienation. So, One of the things that happens here, remember I was saying like delusion and desire and aversion, so the emotional drivers of our karmic process, the process that creates our suffering, the emotional drivers are connected to the delusion or the cognitive driver. And so like when I talk about this, you might be like, oh, I didn't want to think about how the stuff I buy comes from bad stuff. Or maybe like, well, I only buy ethically sourced. So then a delusion comes in to try and protect you from the feeling. A feeling comes up. So this is always an invitation when you recognize the delusion is maybe there's some difficulty there, then see how you feel. When you see how you feel and your mind wants to go, oh look, you want to. But all these things, what they're doing is they're trying to protect you from something from which you don't need protection, which is your life. Now, you can come back to your life now and be like, this is how I feel. This is what I'm thinking. What am I going to do? Ooh. This is how I feel. This is what I'm thinking. This is what I'm going to do. Not this is what I'm thinking like because it's true, but that you just know that you're thinking something. So I went to, spent last weekend at a really great workshop at Clouds and Waters End Center, led by Reverend Angel Kyoto Williams. And it was called Race, Love, and Liberation. And Reverend Angel is one of a very small number of African-American Zen teachers. And so we were just, you know, working on unraveling the collective karma of a race. And one of the things that happened that was really striking is we had this thing where we went around the room and everyone was supposed to say some things about themselves, including identifying how they identify themselves racially. So it was really extraordinary how many people who would write down on a form that they are white, and anyone who saw them would probably just say, you're white, would say, like, I'm Scandinavian. Or, like, I'm Italian. And as we unpacked this, it was pretty clear that people just didn't want to acknowledge that they were white. Because their whiteness is part of a massive, brutal system of oppression that is not over. That is not over. And so the work was just to get down to the emotional level of saying, this is real. Yes, I'm white. The enormous array of privileges I have experienced because of this are part of a brutal system. And, you know, people go, what can I do? Start with just getting to the emotional core of your resistance of that truth. That's a lot of work right there. And that's the kind of work that Buddhism emphasizes. Buddhism emphasizes transforming the internal driving processes, intentional processes, and the action will flow out of that. That compassionate action that really helps will flow out of that. Turn around the light to shine within, then just return. So not only is doing this kind of work of just acknowledging this, you know. So, I don't know about you guys, but there's a lot of discourse right now about race. And I suspect some of you have emotional reactions to it. I do. So can I just listen, see when my mind is coming in and adding delusions, and then feel? Start there. Because what this Mahayana teaching is inviting us to see is that this is not going to be about freeing some other people, magnanimously freeing some other people, but it's about liberating ourselves from an alienation in which we are imprisoning ourselves. Wow! Liberating ourselves. And that act of liberating ourselves from our alienation will make room for the real, authentic connection. Because, you know, it's true that race is just a construct. I mean, right now there's, you know, people, academics, saying it's just a construct. That's cool. But as Mahayana Buddhists, we should know that. It's all just constructs. But back to the point from earlier, the delusion doesn't mean, that delusion doesn't mean it doesn't matter. We're here, together, working through this thing. Working through it. So the practice here I'm talking about is just really opening up your ears, really being sensitive to the emotional contents of experience. And we resist all the resistance we have around the particular issue, say, of race, but any kind of issue, like, oh, guess what? There's also sexist oppression, class oppression, oppression of people because of their sexual preference. And then there's all the just internal oppression we do of ourselves where we're yelling at each other. It's all big system interacting. Wow. We can keep opening up. You're strong enough to do it. We're conditioned to think we're not strong enough to do that work, that we have to hide from it. We can keep opening up. That conditioning says somehow we're going to control this. But it's too big. It's too big. Intimacy. So that's why I put this bell hooks quote on our bulletin. She says, "The practice of love offers no place of safety. We risk loss, hurt, and pain. We risk being acted upon by forces outside our control." We're already being acted on by forces outside our control. It's an illusion that, you know, we can, maybe we try and hold on. You hold on for a year, you hold on for 2 years, it's pretty good, and then, you actually realize. And all of us will meet at the end of our lives. The kind of freedom that this practice is offering is really big. Really big. But we don't get it by making a smaller place for ourselves to crawl into. We get it by opening up, realizing the strength we have to see through our own illusions, realizing the strength we have to sit with our own emotions. And we do it together because sometimes it's discouraging. I can't do it. Well, we come back and do it together. Everyone else is doing it. I can do it. This is love. Intimacy. This is our practice. Thank you for listening. I'm going to invite questions, comments, thoughts.
This seminar you brought up earlier, the MB, some initials.
MBSR.
What was that?
Mindfulness-based stress reduction. It's like a 10-week or 12-week course. Anyone know?
Eight-week
course where you learn to practice mindfulness, and it helps reduce stress. It's really great. It's a great program. Lots of places. It's a national thing.
It's non-secular, so it's stripped of all Buddhist like trappings, but it's actually mindfulness practice. I can tell you about it. I'll be at the table afterwards. I can tell you. I trained in it. Teacher training.
Did you really see Bob Dylan last night?
Yeah. Yes. And I'll tell you, the way he sings, he really confirms something is happening here. You don't know what it is. I saw another hand here.
Thank you for those words. This is very meaningful for me.
I'm going to try to get the sentence out because I just had my mind blown, so I'm going to try to construct the sentence so people can understand. But the more I sit and look and have the opportunity to look inward, the more I kind of start understanding about myself that my thoughts and feelings are so coupled to doing something. And then when I can't do anything about it, or at least do the right thing about it, I get frustrated and angry about that piece of it. So then I'm upset about my thoughts and feelings. I'm upset that I can't do anything. Can you comment on that piece?
Well,
and I'll also say I finished reading Kurt Vonnegut's A Man Without a Country. Mm-hmm. It's one of his last books, and in that book he's just given up. Mm-hmm. It's just one thing after another. He just points it out, and it's so timely, but you can tell he's just given up.
Mm-hmm. Well, what I can say is, in my view, is that Buddhism is fundamentally at the very bottom about empowerment. A kind of empowerment, which is that you can right now do something liberative. And that's usually going to be paying attention in a non-judgmental way. That's going to be the basis of it. And so the recognition that life is very frustrating is at the bottom of it. And yet, just constant reminders that you can do something. But it's not about like running around and trying to fix things. Right. It's about, there's a huge emphasis on the internal process. But it is an active path. I mean, the idea that you only meditate. Is anyone doing that? But that a huge part of it comes down to this deep attentiveness to internal processes. And that can open up some sense of empowerment. It's hard to trust. One of the hardest things about this practice is people do not trust that just sitting down, even for 20 minutes a day, is enough. It's not like enough. You're going to do other things too. But if you give yourself to that process and cultivate that trust, transformation will occur.
Could I comment? Because it's in direct response to what you're saying. I really resonate with your comment. And I think actions can have meaning. What my journey is about is understanding that just being present with the what is has meaning too.
With the what?
Just being present with the what is has meaning too.
Mm-hmm. Nice, nicely put. Thank you. Speak loud so they can hear you back there.
Yes, I was just raised. I want to thank you specifically for stepping us through the experience with a lot of examples. I think that was very, very helpful. I've been coming to this place for 15 years, and I still really benefited from that. What do you call a not paying attention to the feeling situation? You give us some really good examples, so thank you for that. And then I had a thought. I thought, well, do we have to live with our mind that wants to avoid feeling what is unpleasant to feel? And I think we have something that's called a reward system in our mind. Our minds want to be rewarded in some way. That's why we also can become addicted. And maybe it's a little bit that system that sometimes makes it hard for us to take in shattering truth. And maybe if we just know that has an ill reputation, maybe then that's a motivation to say, that crossed my brain. I got it. Now I'm looking. Possibly. Maybe that helps one or two or a half a person.
Thank you. Thank you.
Ben, can you say a little more about the hoops within hoops?
Well, I can't speak with much authority because I don't know much about the Lakota tradition. But, you know, it sounded like he was saying there's, he saw, I think he says, he saw the hoop of his people.
So Sangha.
Sangha, right, yeah, very good. Our Sangha. I saw that the sacred hoop of my people was one of many hoops that made one circle wide as daylight. Oh, well, it doesn't sound concentric there. So, I mean, I don't really know. But what I can say, what am I pointing to at this? The reason I wanted to point that part out is the point where he said everywhere is the center of the universe. So we think, oh, Black Elk had a sacred vision. He must have it. No, your moment of experience is the center of the universe, a profoundly empowered position. Wow. Don't wait for it. Don't wait for someone else, some hero. Don't wait till you're a hero and get real important. All right, well, it's been really nice to be with you, and we're going to be together some more. Thank you all.